Employees became suspicious when Omar Mateen asked for body armor and bulk ammunition because it's unusual for someone who's not in law enforcement to request it. He says Mateen left the store empty-handed and the FBI was contacted. New reports indicate Mateen was texting with his wife during the massacre. NBC News says he responded to a text from his wife, Noor Salman, at 2:30 a.m. The former security guard killed 49 people and wounded 53 others before dying in a shootout with police. This is USA Radio News.
Adopt US Kids presents Multiple Choice Parenting.
You've messed up your daughter's haircut. Do you A, get spiritual?
Mom, where's the mirror?
Beauty is within.
B, find the positives.
Less time blow drying, more time texting.
Or C, show empathy.
Mom, you really don't have
twinsies.
I kinda love it. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information on adoption, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
Have you been to ConservativeTribune.com? Now, this is one of the most visited news sites in the entire world, and the reason is simple. ConservativeTribune.com delivers edgy and bold commentary of the news. They're unapologetically pro-America, unabashedly conservative. At ConservativeTribune.com, they don't make apologies for who they are or what they say. And if you're looking for more than just boring stories and simple thought, you go to ConservativeTribune.com. That's ConservativeTribune.com.
President Obama visited with the families of the victims yesterday of the Orlando massacre. He used the opportunity to promote gun control.
Those who were killed and injured here were gunned down by a single killer with a powerful assault weapon.
He also says Americans must do more to defeat terror. Donald Trump is celebrating the one-year anniversary of his campaign. Speaking in Dallas last night, he talked about the upcoming Republican National Convention and the shooting in Orlando.
And you saw what one sleazebag can do. One sleazebag over the weekend, what he did. The horror that he wreaked on us as a nation.
Trump says President Obama isn't doing enough to keep ISIS out of the country, and those types of shootings won't happen when he's president. Investigators now have the second black box from the Egypt Air jetliner that crashed in the Mediterranean last month. The cockpit voice recorder was found yesterday. This is USA Radio News.
I'm Sean Hare, the site director at ConservativeTribune.com. Conservative Tribune is one of the most visited news sites in the world, and the reason is simple. ConservativeTribune.com delivers edgy and bold commentary of the news every day. We are unapologetically pro-America, unabashedly conservative. At ConservativeTribune.com, we don't make apologies for who we are or what we say. If you're looking for more than boring stories and simple thought, visit ConservativeTribune.com. That's ConservativeTribune.com.
Bernie Sanders is not yet throwing his support behind presumptive Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton. Here's the latest from USA's Chris Barnes.
We do not need a major party candidate who makes bigotry the cornerstone of his campaign.
In an online video message to supporters, Bernie Sanders makes no mention of ending his Democratic campaign, telling them,
"The major political task that together we face in the next 5 months is to make certain that Donald Trump is defeated and defeated badly."
He also vowed that he'll take his campaign for economic equality and social justice to the Democratic convention next month. For USA Radio News, I'm Chris Barnes.
There are reports the man accused of murdering a British member of parliament in the street yesterday supported an American neo-Nazi group. Thomas Mayer was arrested after Labour Party lawmaker Joe Cox was shot and stabbed in Yorkshire. Dish Network is no longer carrying the NFL Network or NFL Red Zone in its programming lineup. The National Football League says its contract expired last night after the two parties were unable to come to terms on a new distribution agreement. Searchers have recovered another black box from the Egypt Air jetliner that crashed in the Mediterranean last month. The discovery of the flight data recorder comes a day after Egypt announced the recovery of the plane's cockpit voice recorder. Both devices are damaged, but searchers were able to recover the memory unit. This is USA Radio News. I'm Kelly Sloan. For more news, we're on the web at usaradio.com.
Good morning, Hunterdon. This is Big C coming to you from HunterdonChamberRadio.com at the studio offices of the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce in Flemington, New Jersey. Good Morning Huntington kicks off your day by providing you with local news, traffic and weather, as well as light topics through Vitamin C, Wake Up Call, and Chamber Chat. I also have many guests focusing on Huntington County community, business, and education. Listen to me every weekday morning from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Good Morning Huntington, HuntingtonChamberRadio.com.
Well, good afternoon. It's Friday, June 17th, 2019. Yeah, that would be kind of where I'm at today. 2016. Beautiful Friday afternoon. The program, It's the Law, and I'll talk about legal issues in a minute. But first of all, I wanted to tell you about this beautiful weekend we're anticipating this afternoon. I think we can forget it. They said there was a slight chance of showers, but honestly, unless it just gets warmer and warmer, I haven't seen clouds. It was a beautiful day. If you have an opportunity to get outside this evening, might be very nice. And it will be partly cloudy tonight, and then there can be some fog, low of about 50 degrees. So it's going to be cooler tonight, nice sleeping weather. Tomorrow, beginning in the morning, patchy fog and then sunny, high of about 81 degrees. So it should be a really pleasant day, mostly clear tomorrow night. And then Sunday, Father's Day, should be sunny and not as scorchingly hot as they had predicted. At least right now, they're saying about low 80s, high of about 83 degrees. So everyone who was worried about that outdoor picnic, I don't think you have to worry. It's not going to be that hot. Luckily, we're not experiencing the weather from the west and the southwest, and especially when it's humid in the Midwest and west. It is, when they say it's killer heat, they really mean it. It is just unbearable. So we're not hitting, getting any of that yet. Into Monday should be sunny, 85 degrees, and perhaps it will be warmer next week. But the weather should be beautiful this weekend, great time to get out. Hope you all have a father or grandfather that you can celebrate the day with. And I think, as I recall, Father's Day was not officially enacted until President Nixon. And I guess I won't comment about President Nixon, but at least he made Father's Day an official holiday. And I think that was probably in about 1972, but I'm guessing at that. So someone who knows is better able to say that. But Mother's Day has been around for, of course, many, many generations. So we'll be back with the program as soon as we tell you a little bit about some of our sponsors. And, well, you'll know why the next one isn't one of my favorites. I don't think that's someone locally.
Lose 20 to 40 pounds in 40 days, guaranteed. Let me repeat, lose 20 to 40 pounds in 40 days, guaranteed. This is not a crazy diet or exercise program, no drugs, hormones, or shots. You can lose 20 to 45 pounds in 40 days with Nutrimost Resonant Frequency Technology to measure 2,800 of your body's key biomarkers. Using NRF, they can find and correct the cause of your weight problem by measuring factors affecting weight gain, including metabolism, fat burning, fat storage, appetite, detoxification, and hormonal regulation. It's safe, fast, easy, and effective, and you won't walk around hungry or have cravings. It's even doctor supervised. Schedule a body composition analysis and consultation. You can be transformed in 40 days guaranteed. This is a limited time offer, so they can't wait to see you look great.
So call 888-718-7077. That's 888-718-7077. Or visit njthin.com. That's njthin.com.
At Crown Trophy of Flemington, we have thousands of products for you to choose from. Whether you're looking for trophies, plaques, or corporate awards, Crown Trophy of Flemington is your one-stop shop. We feature acrylic and crystal awards and promotional products for any occasion. We build and engrave all awards right on site, and we're a leading supplier of varsity jackets for local sports teams. We provide quality customer service and great pricing. Crown Trophy of Flemington is conveniently located in the Staples Shopping Center in Flemington. Crown Trophy of Flemington, we're trophies and a whole lot more.
Well, good afternoon. The program is It's the Law. I'm Pat Smits. I'm an attorney here who practices in Hunterdon County. My office is here in Hunterdon County, and actually I practice throughout the state. But those of you who have listened or know me know that I limit my practice to family law matters. So it would be I'm sure that some people think this is a pretty boring program because I just talk about legal news, but it would certainly be more boring if I only talked about family law matters. So this week I'm just going to give you some of the information that is out there in the legal news. And one of the things that I was really pleased to see is that on June 10th, Governor Christie nominated public defender Joseph Krakora for a second five-year term. I know Joe personally. He actually was an associate in a firm where I was a partner many years ago. He is really dedicated, tough job, and I think he's certainly the person for the job. So I was very pleased to see that. And then, of course, on June 16th, yesterday, Governor Christie nominated Christopher Perino, his former chief counsel, to become the next state attorney general. So that, so we have the attorney general and we have the public defender, both nominated. So that, and both of those nominations really should go through without much difficulty. At least there have been no rumors that I've heard that said that either one of them are going to be shot down. So we'll wait and see. Now, a local judge, meaning a municipal court judge, was suspended for aiding his family in a feud with a contractor. One of the things that people don't often understand is the difference between the municipal court judges and the superior court judges. The superior court judges are appointed by the governor. They are nominated, and they usually go through a review, the Bar Association, and then they go through the when the governor nominates, then they have to go through the process, and they're confirmed through the legislative process. Municipal court judges are different. Most of them are, in at least in the small counties or in the small municipalities, they're part-time. Most of them have their own private practices. There are some full-time municipal judges in places such as Newark, but most of them have private practices. So what happened here is the judge apparently used his authority to inquire into the criminal history of a home renovation contractor with whom his relatives were in dispute. And the Supreme Court of New Jersey suspended him without pay for 1 month based on what they considered this conflict. So what else? The U.S. Supreme Court on Thursday recalibrated the law of copyright fee shifting, telling the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, that's New York, that it was placing too much weight on the objective reasonableness of the party's litigation positions. Have not read that case, but the court was directed to look at that and not put that kind of weight on the reasonableness of the litigation positions. So what has been approved for publication? Well, as of yesterday, there were two cases that are at least of some interest in the appellate division, and the decision was written by Judge Koblitz in the interest of JF, which means that this was a juvenile. And this was an appeal, and the majority affirmed the trial court's denial of the state's juvenile waiver application. In other words, in this case, the state wanted to try the juvenile as an adult. And so they asked the juvenile judge to waive and allow the case to proceed against the defendant juvenile in court, in criminal court, and have him tried as an adult. Now, the court denied that both for the reasons stated by the trial judge in his decision not to waive the juvenile trial, and also on an alternative basis that the new higher statutory age requirement under the statute is appropriately applied retroactively. And because they said it is appropriately applied retroactively, that precluded the waiver of the juvenile JF, who was 14 years old at the time of the shooting that gave rise to the charges. So the state was looking to waive and try this 14-year-old, at least he was 14 at the time of the shooting, and try him as an adult. Now, Judge Gilson, who was sitting on the bench, concurred with the majority based on the decision by the trial judge, but he opined that the appellate court should not have considered the retroactivity of the age provision in the reversal waiver statute because no party raised that issue. And that's important. I tend to agree with Judge Gilson. Ordinarily, the appellate division will not raise an issue themselves. We usually call that sua sponte. In other words, if no party raises an issue, it's highly unusual for the appellate division to make a decision based on an issue that wasn't raised by either side in the appeal. So that's an interesting and, you know, not that Judge Gilson, he did not, the majority, he joined the majority in the opinion, so he did not dissent. There was no dissent, but he just found that one portion of that he didn't agree with the majority. That does not mean that there's a dissent. And the reason that it's very important is that whenever there is a dissent in the appellate division, there is a right to proceed before the New Jersey Supreme Court. I've talked about that before, but that's very important. And I've also said many times before, it's fairly rare that there is a dissent in the appellate division. And if there is, however, then it goes up before the Supreme Court. Otherwise, the only other alternative is to ask the Supreme Court to take the case. And they rarely do. That is, you can file a petition for certification. And they grant some of them, and they deny many more than they grant. So there was also a family law case that is reported. And frankly, I wish there were more family law cases reported. There are many, many cases that really are have important gems in them. There was one recent case, Judge Jones, a trial judge, and he has a number of published opinions, but there was one case recently that I really felt should have been published because there are no published cases on this particular issue, and it's an issue that comes up very often. But in any event, this case, it was a post-judgment dissolution matter. So what does that mean? It means that the parties were already divorced, and there was, in this case, the court held that, and again, it was the appellate division, held that absent changed circumstances where parents' matrimonial settlement agreement clearly provides that they will share their children's college costs equally, then the court need not apply the factors set forth in the seminal case on whether or not parents have to contribute to college. So this is very important. In other words, when parties make an agreement, once again, the appellate division has upheld the party's agreement. And so in this case, there's no need, if someone can point to some provision in the agreement that the parties agreed to pay 50-50 or 60-40, whatever, if it's a clear agreement, then the court doesn't have to decide and determine whether a parent should contribute to a child's college costs and or to the extent of the contribution. Now, in addition, this case was important because it found that where a child is required to seek financial aid to help reduce the costs associated with college, that obligation does not include repaying a Federal Direct Plus loan. And that's a PLUS, plus loan, secured by a parent to satisfy the parent's obligation under the agreement. And so, in other words, if, in fact, the parties say that the child has to apply for loans and scholarships and grants, and frankly, sometimes that's, you really need to be very careful in these agreements because, you know, how many scholarships might there be out there that the child didn't think about applying for? But in any event, as far as loans, if a parent decides to take out a loan, then they're obligated to pay it back, not the child. I think this will certainly clear things up for a lot of the trial judges. And of course, if people can reach agreement with respect to college, it's always better. And the reason it's always better is it can cost more than the first year of college or the first and second year of college just to fight this out in court. So it's certainly, there's a variety of ways to do it. And this is a real problem because I'm not saying that, you know, parents who are barely making it financially should have to fund a child's Ivy League college education. However, there's certainly ways that, people could set aside money, and there's always a concern if one parent sets aside money that maybe he or she will end up having to pay the majority of college. And again, those things should be included in the agreement. Very often, frankly, if children are young, parents just are so tired by the end of the process that they just don't even want to bother dealing with college. But it is very important. And it's important for children to know because, they're often burdened with worrying about whether or not they're going to be able to go to college. So what else is happening? Well, apparently now this is a landmark ruling because the New Jersey Supreme Court ruled this week that the 2-year statute of limitations for filing a lawsuit alleging violations of the state law against discrimination cannot be shortened by a clause in an employment agreement or contract. In other words, you can't have an employment contract with one of your employees saying that they have to bring the lawsuit within 6 months, 1 year, 18 months. So this is a pretty significant situation. And frankly, I can certainly understand it because people who have an employment contract are basically going to sign anything that's put in front of them. So this ends that. There's a 2-year statute of limitations for filing a lawsuit alleging violations of the state law against discrimination. Now, a federal judge in Camden has issued an injunction against the sales of a book by Commerce Bank founder Vernon Hill II after finding that it infringed on the copyright to an earlier work written by Hill but owned by TD Bank. Interesting. And there's been a lot going back and forth between Mr. Hill and TD Bank. So what they said is the book he wrote or had somebody write for him when he was working for the bank, that is the bank's copyright, and he has no right to use any information from that book in his new book. So that's that should probably be something that others look at, and if they've written something for one employer and they go to another employer, who owns, if there's a copyright, who owns the copyright? I guess there were some product safety penalties because Mr. Coffee faced what some people call the messy brew problem. because the brewing chamber on one of its single-serve machines was occasionally popping open and spraying hot water and coffee grounds on customers. So that obviously is not something that's going to get overlooked, put it that way. Now, there's really this cyber wild card, and believe me, I don't know anything about it, but there's an $81 million cyber heist of funds from the Bangladesh Central Bank by way of hacked wire transfer requests sent to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And a lingering question remains regarding the role people played in approving the transfer requests. So, big problem for banks if, in fact, there are inappropriate transfers. And, of course, in this case, $81 million from the bank, the central bank in Bangladesh, would be, you know, just unbelievable as far as that amount of money. I mean, not many banks could survive that, and certainly not smaller banks. So the, as I had said, this employment litigation with the 2-year statute of limitations, that was the name of that case, and it was a Supreme Court case decided by Justice LaVecchia, and the name of it is Rodriguez versus Raymour's Furniture. And that was the case where there was a private agreement, and the court found that a private agreement that frustrates the law against discrimination's public purpose, imperative by shortening the 2-year statute of limitations period for private law against discrimination's claims, cannot be enforced. And the reason for that is there's a public purpose. So whenever the court finds a public purpose, a public policy, that you have to be very careful to look at the statutes if you're in fact writing some kind of an agreement that you want employees to sign. Now, there was, there's a criminal law case, and actually the defendants, the co-defendants in this case, were indicted for offenses resulting from their conduct in 2002. And at that time, they drove their sister to a wooded area near the New Jersey Turnpike so she could hide her dead child's body. Pretty bizarre. And the law division judge applied the DNA exception to the 5-year statute of limitations in denying defendants motion to dismiss the indictment. So we'd have to look at the criminal statute, which is NJSA 2C:1-6, paren C and paren. So the conspiracy count of the indictment, which alleged obstruction in that the co-defendants intimidated the victim's sister into silence, survived because it was a continuing offense. So that's interesting. They felt that it was a continuing offense, and there was a the case that looks at that is State versus DiOrio, a 2014 case. However, in this case, the appellate division found that the DNA exception did not apply to any charge as the DNA match only identified the victim and not the actor as required by the statute, and they referred to another case. The denial of the motion to dismiss the indictment was reversed except for the conspiracy count. So there's still the conspiracy count, but this is going back to 2002, so 14 years ago this happened. Now, there are a number of other cases that were not approved for publication. Many of them are very interesting. In fact, I sometimes wonder why some cases are approved for publication and others aren't. I mean, for example, certainly the this case, the criminal case, the criminal law case that was approved, you know, it's pretty, I don't want to say esoteric, but very unusual. I guess they published it because of the issue of conspiracy, and they thought that would be clarifying some part of the law on conspiracy. So there have been a number of decisions recently that New Jersey courts have invalidated allegedly unclear arbitration agreements. Now, why is that important? Well, people can agree and often do agree by contract to arbitration rather than proceeding in court. And so it's important that the arbitration agreement be clear. Now, after a short break, I'm going to come back and I'll continue talking about that because one of the most important things in arbitration is, in fact, the arbitration agreement. And I handle arbitration in family law matters, and so the focus initially is what is the arbitrator charged in doing. So after breaks for our sponsors, I'll come back and we'll talk about it.
Don't fear technology. Use it, understand it, and embrace it. The mission of Tech Today is to demystify technology. I'm your host, Chris Bianco, principal of Blue Panther Business Partners. Every Tuesday morning from 10 to 11, we will cover new apps, buying advice, technology news, and answer your questions. Good day, and join me on Tech Today on HuntertonChamberRadio.com.
This is Tony Clark, para planner at Patton Heidi & Associates. Americans believe they should be in charge of their own future, how they will live tomorrow. Since 1894, Ameriprise Financial has worked for their clients' futures, helping millions of Americans retire on their terms, when they want, where they want, doing what they want. Today, Patton Heidi & Associates, a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., remains true to the vision of always putting clients first. We are ready to help you put a confident retirement more within reach. Put the strength of a leader in retirement planning to work for you through a personal one-to-one relationship. Patton Heidi & Associates will work with you to develop a plan to help you pursue your retirement goals. Call today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor, Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., member FINRA and SIPC.
Hi, I'm Joe Peters of Weikert Realtors. Buying or selling a property can be one of the most expensive undertakings you face in your lifetime. And selecting the right realtor to help you through this process can dramatically affect your success or your failure. I have personally helped hundreds of buyers and sellers through this process in achieving their dreams and goals in 100 in Somerset County areas over the past 10 years. I believe that this experience should be a smooth, seamless one for you and not a roller coaster ride. But the best judgment as to whether or not I deliver this to my customers is their reactions in their own words.
One of the things we liked about Joe was that he would return calls within minutes if he wasn't able to pick up.
You know, Joe guided us through the process of selling our home and made a complicated transaction appear seamless.
How do I accomplish this? By approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, I try to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them my own. Then, I go out and take the mass amounts of data that we have and distill them down to a few understandable action points to be considered. Finally, I control the entire process through technologies to ensure that we're not going to hit any speed bumps along the way. The end result to you is a smooth, rewarding customer experience. Let me show you how to take my level of professional expertise and put it to work for you in achieving your real estate goals and dreams. I can be reached at 908-238-0118. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Joel. I'm always uplifted by his voice. He does a great commercial or sponsor ad or whatever we call them. So I'm back. This is Pat Smits. We're talking about arbitration and the fact that New Jersey courts have invalidated a number of unclear arbitration agreements recently. So this, a split New Jersey Supreme Court, did so again. Now, the case was Morgan versus Stanford Brown Institute, and the majority opinion was written by Justice Albin. It's a 58-page opinion, if anyone wants to read it. But what the court held, the majority held, that the arbitration provision and the purported delegation clause in the enrollment agreement failed to comply with requirements of two cases, a U.S. Supreme Court case, 1995 case, and a New Jersey Supreme Court case in 2014, which cert was denied by the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court in that case. So the majority also held that they failed to satisfy the elements necessary for the formation of a contract, so that however this was written, it was not a contract, and consequently, whether the parties agreed to arbitrate their dispute is an issue for determination by the court. And the court holds that the arbitration and delegation provisions of the agreement are unenforceable. So this means that in this case, there are two issues. One, they really have to have a trial to determine whether or not the parties agreed to arbitrate their dispute. And if the court finds they did not agree to arbitrate the dispute, then there would have to be a trial at the trial court level. So that it's very important. Well, it's important for all agreements, but it's very important if there are arbitration provisions written in an agreement that, in fact, they're clear and exactly what the arbitration is going to do and the arbitrator is going to handle. For example, in a family law case, if the party said, well, they wanted me to arbitrate alimony, unless we expanded that agreement to include ancillary issues that come up, for example, whether or not the alimony has to be, whether or not life insurance has to be in place to guarantee the alimony, that would be beyond the scope of the arbitration agreement unless, in fact, the parties agreed that not only alimony, but whether the payer of alimony should be have to fund life insurance, any other things, whether or not there might require the payor to pay other direct expenses that would not be taxable. I would be sure to make sure that the parties understood that when we use the term alimony, we would agree that that meant that the either it could be taxable or non-taxable alimony, or the definition of alimony would be taxable to the recipient and deductible to the payor. Now, I know that sounds like Greek to many people, but what it means is that under the statute, if there are certain, if someone pays alimony and there's certain criteria set into an agreement, then the person who pays the alimony can deduct that amount from his or her tax returns, and the person who receives alimony has to include that as income in his or her tax returns. And so it's a shifting of taxes. And so that one of the issues would be, is that part of what the arbitrator can decide? In other words, is there an agreement that any alimony will be considered taxable? Could the arbitrator determine some alimony is taxable, but other alimony might not be taxable? And, of course, not only would the alimony be the amount of alimony, but the term of alimony. whether there are any other ancillary things such as life insurance, medical insurance, you know, all of those things should be in the agreement so that everybody, when they go to arbitration, they can, in fact, the arbitrator makes a decision just on the issues that are before the arbitrator in arbitration. Now, for example, the difference is in a court, a judge will make a decision on all the issues. I mean, you don't have to tell the judge, although we do, you wouldn't really have to tell the judge, you know, alimony is taxable. The judges would know that. It would be part of it. On the other hand, in arbitration, let's assume that people have, you know, 10-year-old twins and a 12-year-old. Now, and I will say that there's always an exception to everything, but ordinarily, if there was a divorce trial, the trial judge would not make any determination with respect to college for these children because of their age. In other words, the issue is not ripe. The judge would basically tell people, you know, come back when the children are of age that they're about to go to college. So the difference is with arbitration, if I'm the arbitrator and people come in and say, look, we want to deal with all of these issues, including college and the responsibility for college, we want to deal with those issues now, the arbitrator could, in fact, deal with those issues now, even though they would not be considered ripe. And the reason that the difference is that the people, the litigants, give the arbitrator the power as to what he or she can decide. So in any event, that's one of the differences. But the really important thing is to not just use some boilerplate agreement. You really have to look at the arbitration agreement. And many attorneys don't even realize that. There are a couple arbitration statutes, and they kind of just say, well, we'll go with one or the other, without really looking at how important it is to figure out for their, you know, for their case and for the specific issues, you know, just what do they want the arbitrator to do. Now, every time I mention arbitration, somebody says, well, what's the difference between arbitration and mediation? The difference is that an arbitrator, if everything is done right, an arbitrator, I guess the easiest way to say it is the arbitrator sits as a judge would sit and makes decisions. And they're just some minor reasons as to why an arbitration award can be appealed. That's why you're seeing in so many of these cases, they're not appealing the arbitration award. They're actually appealing and saying that the arbitration agreement was invalid. Because if they say that the arbitration agreement was valid, there would be very limited circumstances on which they could actually appeal. Now, a New Jersey attorney was found in contempt, and a warrant was issued based on his informal advice to his brother about a case pending before the judge in Cleveland Federal Court. Excuse me. I don't have any more information about that situation, but certainly certainly interesting. Now, the Newark Watershed Conservation and Development Corporation has agreed to a $1 million settlement with Genova Burns over the firm's role in advising the agency before it filed for bankruptcy. So, wow, that's pretty significant. There's also a defamation suit and a six-year-old quest by a defendant to be awarded counsel fees and sanctions in a defamation suit that was deemed to be frivolous. And that, of course, continues. Some of these cases never end. Well, there really haven't been many cases for published cases this past week. One of the things that's New Jersey and the State Department of Education have not been able to receive insurance coverage for their contribution to a $5 million settlement over claims stemming from Newark schoolyard murders in 2007. And the State Appellate Division has ruled on that. So, you know, taxpayers, once again, that's another $5 million that, you know, the state's going to pay out of our, looks like it, the state's going to pay out of our taxes. I'm not sure that there, I think this is possibly the same case about arbitration, but there's some more discussion about it. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is taking comments on a proposed rule that would prohibit financial services companies from locking consumers into arbitration. And apparently this would be pretty significant, obviously. Don't know where that's going. And if it comes up again, I'll certainly let everybody know. But it doesn't seem like that's going to be something that's dealt with very quickly. Now, I don't know if I mentioned this. I don't think I did, but if I did last week, it's worth mentioning again. What happened, and I may have mentioned this, because the Supreme Court, New Jersey Supreme Court, threw out the challenge to the portion of Governor Christie's 2011 Pension Reform Act that suspended state pension cost of living adjustments. And, you know, I don't think anybody wants to pay more taxes. And I know that I've had a discussion about this with some of my attorney friends, and they feel that that's fine. It concerns me when someone has worked for any entity, including the state, for many years, assuming that they may have worked for a lower salary with the understanding that they would be getting a good pension, including cost of living adjustments. And so that people are becoming very, very concerned, about what they thought were rights, what they thought were contract rights, being taken out of them, the rug pulled out from under them. So it's, some people argue the state doesn't have the money. Well, I understand that, and I certainly understand that the people who are getting 2 and 3 and 4 pensions, that's pretty ridiculous. However, the regular wage earner who worked for, 25, 30 years at a state job where they paid or were paid less based on the fact that they thought they'd be able to retire and their retirement would keep up with the cost of living, you have to really think about how fair that is to them. There was Bridgegate, again, in the... I can't find the article on it, but there was a, once again, they're not out of the Bridgegate litigation. I guess that will go on for the next few years because in any event, the court rejected some latest motion brought by the Bridgegate defendants, William Baroni Jr. and Bridget Ann Kelly. So that was, they filed a motion or an application to toss out their indictment as fatally flawed. Didn't work. So that continues on and on and on. There's also a class action over General Mills, against General Mills, and their Kix cereal label, Kix, K-I-X, cereal label, because it says made with all natural corn. And so the lawsuit is over the wording of the label. But apparently that has been stayed while the U.S. Food and Drug Administration considers regulating the use of the term natural on all food labels. So I think that sometimes when people read a label and they think it's natural, I think, frankly, many of these food companies are really deceptive when they use that term. Sure, it's not just General Mills. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, how the term natural will be defined in the future. Because, genetically changed corn, is that natural? GMOs, I mean, there are lots of discussions about these things. So it would be fair, and it is fair, only fair, I think, now that we have labeling, so people can really understand what does that mean, and if what does natural mean. I think the same thing as we would certainly expect if something's labeled organic, to know that it was grown organically. Now, we won't go into that further, but the point is, some of these things are to protect consumers. Now, recently, the U.S. Supreme Court decided it was a decision involving a church sign that revived a First Amendment challenge brought up by free speech advocates and pornographers against records retention statutes aiming at curbing child pornography. Now, frankly, I know nothing more about this than this blurb, but First Amendment challenge, since it was a decision, and the decision was involving a church sign. I might have to find that federal case and Supreme Court case to see exactly, what they were, how they're able to use that. Now, a lawyer is bringing a suit against debt incurred to prepare for her bar exam, and the lawyer sues a student loan servicer over the bar preparation. There's a course, and that was discharged, or she's trying to discharge it in bankruptcy. Not so sure that makes a lot of sense. Certainly can't be that much, and that it is what it is. But certainly people file bankruptcy for right reasons, and when they really can't pay, and they get overwhelmed, medical debts and other debts. But I guess I shouldn't personally say that. Wait, if you went to law school and took a bar exam prep course, should pay for it. Let's see what else. Well, that's getting close to the end of the program. A couple other things have come up recently, and maybe I should share them with you. Custody is a real issue in many cases, and I have to say it's something that people should somehow figure out a way to resolve. And however, one of the things that is most difficult is when, in fact, one parent wants to move from the state of New Jersey to another state and take the child or children. But what's come up and a lot of discussion lately is at what point, at what age, is a child's age relevant to the determination of custody? And, at the onset, age is a determinative factor as to the court's jurisdiction to grant custody, which generally ends when a child reaches the age of 18, the age of majority. But in the context, because the judges have to look at the best interest, and that's the way they determine custody, and custody can be many things. In New Jersey, we actually use parenting time. We use custody, joint custody, sole custody. But in the majority of cases, people are awarded joint legal custody. And then the issue is whether one parent is a parent of primary residence and the other the parent of alternative residence. But again, the best interest analysis in the statute, NJSA 9:2-4, requires consideration of the desires and preference of any child who is, and the quote is, of sufficient age and capacity to reason. So that, you know, so what does that mean? Well, of course, all the judges, you know, can look at that individually. But this, for example, there's cases go back to an appellate case of 1998. Then there was a Wilkie versus Cup, which is even earlier, in 1984. In that case, the New Jersey Supreme Court denied certification. There is recently a case, the appellate division in 2014, and they reversed a custody determination that did not take into consideration views of a 14-year-old child. And then there was an earlier case back in the 80s that concluded that consent of a 14-year-old was a starting point with respect to a removal case. And so that, you know, if the child, you know, was objecting to the move and was 14 years old, you know, the court should not override that in general. I mean, there are obviously circumstances. But there's also a case in 2010 explaining that a 15-year-old's position on the issue of relocation in a custody dispute was a potentially important factor for the court's consideration. So, of course, you know, we're talking 15 years old, and that would be very important. And again, there's a case back in the 70s providing that even though an 8.5-year-old child lacked the maturity and judgment to make a dispositive statement of custodial preference, the court still, under that circumstance, should consider the child's wishes along with other relevant factors. Now, of course, in 1991, Quinn versus Johnson said that the wishes of an 18-year-old were very important for the court to consider upon determining his best interest regarding custody. And, you know, going back almost 40 years, considering the preferences of a 12-year-old child in awarding custody to a stepmother with whom the child lived. So now that was, you know, that was certainly different because we're talking about a stepmother, not a biological parent. And there are other cases where, you know, younger children, even, you know, 10, 6, even that young, whether they should be, you know, looked at. And going back to as early as 1907, at least the children at that point, they said children of 9, 11, and 14, those children were of suitable age to at least express a preference. And then, of course, there's another case providing that the preference in custody cases is given to the parent with the strongest psychological bond with the child. And I think most people recognize now that children have psychological bonds with both parents. So what happens in these cases, and I'm going to go on to you know, close out the program in just a couple minutes, but generally the child's preference is elicited through the judge having an interview, what we call an in-camera interview, in chambers that neither parent participate in and the lawyers don't participate in, and also, of course, of the mental health expert testimony of the mental health expert who has met with the child. However, again, preference is not dispositive and is only to be given due weight under the custody statute. And we can go on and on about court. The appellate divisions will find that the trial court need not be bound by the child's view, but that it cannot be the basis for denying the child the right to express a view. So in other words, the trial judge doesn't have to go along with the child's view, but the child should be entitled to express a view if they're of reasonable age to do so. And as we know, those of us who practice, the weight afforded to a child's preference is directly proportional to the child's age. Older